Hi.
Hi.
Hello.
Hey. So, you wrote this thing?
Me and a couple other guys.
Okay. Well, so tell me, where did the whole idea of making it Apocalypse Con come from?
That was probably like the first... here's the story. So that was I was on Godzilla in post-production, and Thomas Tull, who's the sort of head of... He was the founder of Legendary at the time. He was the head of Legendary, and is a huge fan of Godzilla and Kong, came to me and said, you know, King Kong, what do you think? And eventually Kong versus Godzilla. I was like, well, that sounds challenging but cool, potentially. Yeah. So I went off and thought. And part of the challenge was, okay, like, Kong traditionally is this Beauty and the Beast story, and he dies. And so how do we do that in a way where he doesn't die but still respects, and also probably isn't a Beauty and the Beast story for various reasons, but we've also seen it a lot. And so how do we do it in a way that respects the kind of fundamentals of a character, this thing that's misunderstood, that's not a monster but seems to be a monster, and also make him a character that's going to be of a scale that could potentially interact with Godzilla and in this same universe. And so my initial idea when I came back before I wrote anything was, I said, you know, look, I was like, well, I love Apocalypse Now. It's one of my favorite movies. And I was like, well, what about It's a Journey Upriver movie? Mm. And the initial idea was to put it, there was going to be a little beginning of the movie section, almost the way that this movie has a World War II section. I mean, the beginning of the movie was going to be in the 60s, like during the Vietnam War. And someone like lands on the island, whatever, and then you cut forward to the present day, and the movie takes place in the present day. And Thomas's, because he's very much a science-driven thinker, like he likes to think plausibly, and his question was, well, wait a minute, how do you plausibly explain how an island couldn't have been discovered today? Okay, good question. So we took that idea and basically did that idea, set it before the original Kong, during World War I, where it was a similar thing of a soldier returning home, and it was this Heart of Dark, and that's also the kind of era of Heart of Darkness, so it was this Heart of Darkness thing of going upriver. And then I was having lunch with Jordan, who was not yet on the movie, but who was gonna talk to Thomas about potentially doing the movie, and I was telling him what it was, because he was like, Kong, like, I don't know, it's just the same story. I was like, well, actually, it's not the same story. What we're doing is, and I was writing the present day version at the time, I was like, what we're doing is it's going to be, you know, this Apocalypse Now thing where we're going, you know, upriver and whatever. And he's like, oh, that's kind of interesting. So he went and talked to him, comes out, and he's like, his big idea, which was, well, let's actually do it in the 70s.
Yeah.
And not go present and not go in the deep past. And I think it was like, maybe it was him, or maybe it was John Gatens who came up with the idea of actually Landsat and this like notion of how to explain it, and whatever. But basically, like, but it's funny because that aspect, which was the first thought, which we then overthought our way out of, which is so typical, time, and kind of come. And he was like, "No, the music's cool. It looks cool. It feels cool. Just do it." And it's stuck. And that aspect of it, I think, is really interesting and fresh.
Well, and now the whole movie, I mean, when Jackson came in here, I said, wow, you embodied, you know, the entire conflict of the Vietnam era.
Yeah.
You know, pretty much all sides of it in one character. But now this thing, it's a metaphor for Vietnam.
Well, I've been saying,
Vietnam,
you know, it's interesting. It's Vietnam, but it's like, it is for the Vietnam War. But I actually think, you know, we often think of the Vietnam War from a really, really narrow perspective as being the first war that was modern in the sense of there was no clear good and bad.
Yeah.
But actually, it's not the first war like that. It's probably, there have only been two wars in the history of wars that I can think of where there's a clear good and bad.
Yeah.
The Civil War and World War II, and I don't know what else.
Yeah.
Like, I can't think of a single other war personally. I'm not the biggest student of history, but I like it. And, like, I think everything else is about some wedding and some land, and it's bullshit, you know?
Yeah.
And so if you're, money and whatever. Yeah. So if you, and that's the way it's been since. And Vietnam was the first after this conflict where this, you know, World War II was, and prior to that, you know, but, you know, World War One was a meaningless conflict, right, in some, in many, many, many ways.
Right,
and yet,
right,
soldiers, it's all the same. It's not about, mm-hmm, meaning. Like, your meaning is your people you're fighting with, and your, and there's meaning and heroism and bravery in that. But the coming home, because it was a more modern world, and it now is the same after ever since Vietnam, people are not afraid to say, well, that war didn't mean anything, and then, but you as a soldier who lost lives,
mm-hmm,
that how does that, it's, that sits uneasily, like, yeah, your people, you want to believe that people you cared about died for something. So for Sam's character, which is, you know, the, sort of such a core of the movie, here you go, you come out of this world that's gray area. You go in thinking you're a soldier who, he probably was like a young guy in Korea and like, yeah, grew up thinking of World War II, and here he goes to the war and he comes out and nothing seems to mean anything anymore. Or we the bad guys? I thought we were the good guys. You land on an island and this giant monster destroys so many of your men, and suddenly it's clear. He's a bad guy. That thing is, it's black and white again.
Yeah.
Like, that's bad. I'm good. We're going to destroy that thing. And everything seems clear. And, of course, the story is that it's not clear. The story is that it's gray area. Just the, that's what the world is. And in the case of Kong, he's misunderstood. And he's actually not a villain. But that seems to me to be a very universal thing. And it's not just about people returning from war. Like, we're dealing with it right now. Where it's like anything... You know, there's a very, very real temptation in the world to just anything that seems, you know, scary or different, you cast as this other, and it's an enemy, and it's like your problems will be solved if you destroy this thing, when in fact, the reality of the world is that life is more complicated and that empathy is required. And the key to Kong is that he's not a scary monster if you have empathy for him.
Did you read Goodman's opening line in the movie? And... If you
no,
did,
I wish
you know?
I did. I love that line.
how
and
did
no,
you know,
it wasn't.
How did you know 2 years
I know,
ago?
But it wasn't written. It was. It was actually. It's funny. I honestly don't know who wrote it. But it was
okay.
Like because I wrote that. I wrote that scene. But like it, I don't know where it came from.
You know, right,
and
right,
but it was shot really late, and it was shot after the election.
Oh, okay.
So, you're writing the two other movies.
The other one is the Kong versus Godzilla is yet to be. It's only a glimmer in the eye of everybody.
Okay, because at the end credits we get a glimmer of what's to come. So how far in advance do you have it planned out when you're writing Kong? I mean, how far in advance
terms
do you
of
think
the, well, I mean, like, I, you know, and I'm like, it's a big, a lot of people are putting their heads together on these movies, but like, my involvement in terms of, like, you'd like to think about the larger arc,
mm-hmm,
but the way the, you know, stories take shape in the process is, it's, you know, you never know. You can't. You're not thinking beat by beat in terms
right.
of the micro, but you're thinking, okay, how are we going to set this up in plausible, credible way where we can eventually get Godzilla and Kong into the same room? You know,
right. and, you set up organization already.
Yeah, and the monarch is the key, and the monarch is the connector that you know comes for that. You know, I did in the first Godzilla we did, and that whole idea of that was to be able to facilitate this larger universe and like allow a plausible reality that these things have existed. Some people have known aspects of it, but it's been largely kept quiet, and so it's you know, it's refillable in that way. It's given us enough leeway as connective tissue to be able to do these other things, you know.
Was the ship that John Goodman talks about attacked by Godzilla? Is that something that is
The ship to use it? No, it wasn't Godzilla.
Mm.
Yeah, not Godzilla.
Was there any particular scene that was cut and that will be extended on the DVD or Blu-ray?
That's a good question. I'm not the person to ask about that. I don't know. I actually doubt it. I doubt it. Is the truth.
In crafting a worthy adversary for Godzilla in the future, how important not only the size and the thing that you mentioned that he's still growing, but also his ability to use weapons and things.
Which is very different.
How
Godzilla,
important was for you to introduce that in this moment?
Yeah, well, I mean, the thing about Kong is that Kong is, he's a primate. And he's, you know, it's the thing that makes him more relatable than Godzilla. You know, he's human-like. And so that's what people do, you know. And we as humans, you wouldn't look at us naked in a on the savannah and think like, well, shit, they're gonna win, you know. But somehow, like, a little bit larger brain and opposable thumbs matter, and you know, his are actually kind of opposable, more than like a normal, more than your normal ape. But anyway, that, you know, tools are a big part of that. You know, he'll never be quite as big as Godzilla, but and moreover, like, you know, the challenge of that movie is going to be there. Well, they're not, and neither of them is a bad guy, mm-hmm. you know, and neither of them is even out to hurt or would, by the natural course of its existence, hurt people. So the challenge is going to be how to get them into that movie and have them fight, but maybe that's not the end of it. You know, maybe there's a misunderstanding there too. Mm-hmm. You know, where they're not in fact at odds.
How much fun was it writing death scenes?
Which scenes?
Death scenes. You know, when certain characters are going to die.
Oh, death scenes. Yeah, that was fun. I mean, Sandler's accent was like, well, he has to be, you know, saying like, you motherfucker, right before he gets killed. And like, you know, it's fun to think about people getting destroyed in different ways by cool monsters. You know, that's always fun. Yeah.
Well, my favorite part of the original King Kong was the Skull Island stuff, when he'd fight the dinosaurs and all that.
Mm-hmm.
And besides Apocalypse Kong, my favorite part of this movie is, boy, there's just monster fight after monster fight,
yeah,
after monster fight. And was that in your original drafts, or is it something Jordan brought in later?
Yeah, no, that was always the fun of this, is that it's Skull Island. The fun of it is that it's not just a movie about, it's not just the King Kong myth. He's not getting taken back to New York, you know? So it's about the island. What are these other creatures there? And the creatures evolved, and like a version of the skull crawlers, they're called. Because they had different names over the course of time, as like trademarks got worked out. But like the version of that as it always existed, they were never really supposed to be dinosaurs. They were all, because we wanted to do something a little different and keep it just in the vein of these like massive unidentified terrestrial organism things that we had in Godzilla, like these just strange different creatures that like predated, you know, some. I mean, we had a thing in mind, at least I always did, that there was like the, now I think it's in like one of the, like the Godzilla comic or something that I wrote, but like there's an actual asteroid, the Permian extinction, which like predated all the dinosaurs, any of them, but it was like, it destroyed all life on Earth pretty much, apart from cellular and small things. And it's cool to imagine that there was like, you know, that's what these creatures existed, and then the surface world became, you know, less habitable, and maybe they've been here all along, and, you know, so that's sort of the underlying mythology. But on this island and other places potentially like it, there are kind of little emergence points, and there are other things there that beggar the imagination.
So I want to ask you, obviously we're moving away from that token minority, like Jason was joking
so
around, like,
sure.
I got to, you know, survive. And it was very diverse. When you write, do you write with that in mind, or it just comes in the acting? I mean, the director has that.
It's a combination of both. In the case of, in this movie, it was the idea from the beginning was that to get away from the, there's a very traditional thing in the Kong movies that, you know, apart from the, you know, the sort of damsel in distress thing that's a bit uncomfortable and old-fashioned, there's also this weird and very old-fashioned, kind of mildly, if or not mildly, racist thing of, like, the white Westerners arriving in some exotic island where there's, like, natives with spears, and it's like, you know, and so we didn't want to do that. And so there are people who live on this island, but they're not, I hope, not treated in that way, and also they're not kind of, you're not coming there and, like, oohing and aahing at the people. You're there about the nature. Like, we're here because an international group of people, like representing modern humanity, has discovered something that is strange and uncanny and seems impossible from a nature perspective, and all of these people are coming there to study it, basically. And so it's not about the West meeting the East or whatever. It's about people discovering something about the world that they were unaware of, you know, and so that, you know, that kind of that cast sort of just becomes like, that makes sense. That's what the world looks like, and that's what it should be, you know.
Was there a backstory to John C. Reilly's character as far as how he survived with these people who can't talk?
Yeah.
Able to communicate with them, or is that to kill or be killed?
I think, I mean, not all of it, but yeah, I think, like, you know, you meet that, like, just the character itself answers that question, because he's such a teddy bear. Like, how do you, you couldn't hurt him. You know, and there's, you know, there's just some sense of them, of like, you know, the fact that they're able to coexist in nature over time with Kong without seeing Kong as a villain speaks to the fact that they see the world in a way that's less individualistic and less adversarial than, like, you know, modern culture tends to. So, like, they don't come in thinking, how do we get ours and, you know, mow the lawn. They think about how do we, you know, that we're a piece of this larger puzzle, and Kong is at the top of it, and we're in it somehow. And, you know, so, you know, once that, you know, his challenge was, how does a guy who, like, eats hot dogs at, you know, Wrigley Field manage to, like, fall and, you know, allow himself to liberate himself to be a part of this much old, more old-fashioned and more in tune with nature kind of existence.
Have you watched Batman, Lego Batman?
No, I want to see it.
Kong is a bad guy in that movie.
Oh, is he?
So how do you feel about that?
Oh, that's all right.
Thank
thanks, guys.
Thank you.